must be on you but cannot see you. Fuel is running low. We are on the line 157337, running north and south.
Welcome to the Oddity Archive with Evan and David.
Should I read Jess's thing just to set us up?
Sure, if you want to. Only if you do it in a feminine 20s voice.
Yeah, I'll bring a lot of lilt.
I don't know what that is.
We must be on you, but cannot see you. Fuel is running low. I'm not done yet. We're on the line 157337, running north and south. About to inhale some pizza, then say, oh, sorry, that's your text.
Okay, all right. I know we're not going to use that take, but I need you to do it again. Less dramatic and more life or death situation.
Am I Amelia in this scenario?
These are the last radio transmissions she ever made.
And she was like a boss, so like.
Yeah, we're going to get into that.
We must be on you, but cannot see you. Fuel is running low. Sorry, now I'm just making it. I'm making it like Russian.
We must be on you, but cannot see you.
Oh my God.
Like a confident woman, I guess, is not a role I'll ever be cast to play. Confused woman with brain damage. That's more my speed.
If we decide to include those, that's Evan's attempt at doing Jess's cold open lines.
Yeah. And I think they're going to sound pretty much the same.
Pretty identical, I think, after you auto-tune them.
Yeah.
So yeah, good start to season three. We're jumping back in. It's been a bit since we talked with Sarah.
Yeah.
I got another tattoo 3 days ago, and the tattoo artist, Tanis, the one that made our logo, She was asking how the podcast was going. And I said, it's going well. It's going better than I thought it would go. And I've enjoyed it because it's kind of turned into like 80% paranormal, ghost, odd happenings, and like 20% catching up with an old friend and going down a nostalgia rabbit hole.
Yeah.
And so it's sort of morphed into sort of both of those things. And I've really enjoyed that.
Which I didn't think that would happen as much as it did. But I mean, it makes sense that we would like reconnect and then be like, oh, remember that neighborhood we grew up in? For some reason, I didn't think that stuff would enter as much as it did, but it's been fun to kind of just recount some of that stuff from back in the day.
Yeah. And so we'll see what random repressed childhood memories we can drum up this season.
Yeah.
But you said you were talking earlier that you got another unidentified package delivered.
I did. So it played out kind of similar to last time. I was at work, I come home and I'm like, what did I have like too much champagne this weekend and buy something I've wanted for a while?
Much you have your champagne parties on the weekends. Yeah, trying to be, yeah, Larry Bader.
Yeah, I'm going full Bader, and maybe I finally bought something that I've been like pensive to kind of pull the trigger on. So yeah, I see this package, I bring it inside and I open it up, and any guesses?
No, I'm assuming it's something with a practical usage, but you are using it as an alcohol accessory.
Unfortunately, this device doesn't have much volume to it, so okay, you could only fit like a sip or two in there. So I opened the package. It's a Blu-ray movie.
Oh.
It's Kingdom of Heaven Director's Cut.
It happened.
It finally happened.
You got your wish.
So my advice to you is, if you want to make sure you get something on your Christmas list, just start a podcast and single out your family on it and tell them how they failed you. It may not even be Christmas. You might just get it in spring because they feel bad. So
that's true.
Worked out great for me.
I'm going to have to start thinking about what I need to drop. Sisters, if you're listening.
we just got to start plugging things that we want and then holding people like it's their fault.
I'll just broadcast my Christmas list on the podcast. And that way people have to get me what I want.
I was also thinking we could just like start shamelessly plugging things this season and just see if we start getting some free swag from places.
I don't know if you saw it, but I sent you the typed letter that I am snail mailing to Grape Nuts, asking them to be the official cereal of the Oddity Archive.
I did see it. I read it. It's great. I think we've got a good shot. I can't imagine any other person on the planet has gone for it because it tastes terrible. But
don't say that. We're trying to get a sponsor.
Oh, sorry. It was good and good for you.
There we go. Just bleep out the first part.
Yeah. Just a 30-second bleep of me going on a rant about how it tastes like pieces of bark.
Bleep it.
Oh, sorry. But I did complete the challenge, so there is that. If you didn't see that excellent advertising piece for Grape Nuts, the best cereal that's ever been made, maybe one of the best products ever made.
There we go. That's how we do it.
That's
better.
What we're after.
Yeah.
I took one bite and I started weeping because the flavors were so just exquisite.
The crunchy nuggets of love.
I feel like this podcast is also becoming a cereal podcast on the side.
Well, it kind of is.
And I don't even eat it, but I don't know how we got to Grape Nuts again, but so I saw your letter that you wrote them.
Yeah.
Great work, by the way. That's why I think we've got a shot.
Oh, I'll keep you updated.
If I was there, I'd be like, oh my God, somebody loves this stuff. Like, we've got to get them in here. But there is another letter that you wrote. Over the break, I found out that you are an NBA free agent.
It's true. Not many people know this.
I had never heard this. This was news to me. You've got the height. I just didn't know you had the ball skills.
It is true. I have an official letter from the NBA telling me that I am a free agent and I'm free to sign with any NBA team. I got the idea, and I'll post pictures of the letters that I sent to the NBA on our Instagram, but I just kind of spontaneously was like, I wonder if I could go to, I don't even know if the NBA does a combine, but that's what it's called in the NFL, where all the college players go and like show their skills and everything.
Yeah.
And I just had the thought, could I participate in the NBA version of that and just see what happens? And so I wrote the NBA, I typed out a letter and just sent it USPS to like attention. I don't even remember the name of the NBA commissioner, but I sent it directly to him with whatever address I could find.
Yeah.
Essentially saying that I have no basketball skills, but I'm 6 feet tall. My BMI says that I'm slightly overweight and I think I'm just the right fit for an NBA team. And I just sent it, you know, just to see if they would allow me to participate. And they actually mailed me back, asked for more information, wanted to know about my college career, wanted to know more in depth about my experience with basketball. And so I sent them another letter going further in depth about how I have never played organized basketball in my entire life.
Yeah.
I even referenced you in those letters saying that my only experience playing basketball was playing on a broken hoop on the street corner with my friends.
Yeah. You're like, I used to dunk over this guy who was 2 feet shorter than me in high school. And I felt like I was pretty good.
Right. And so I sent that off and they sent me a letter back. It's an official letter on NBA cardstock. Cardstock's probably the wrong word, but you know what I'm going for. Saying that because my college eligibility is up, I am now officially a free agent in the NBA.
So any offers or like where are you at right now?
Well, you know, I'm just marketing myself really. If any owners are listening, if any general managers are listening, if any NBA players are listening, all I'm asking for is you know, let me come try out. Let me shoot a few hoops.
You're not asking for too much.
No,
right?
No. I mean, and just, you know, let's see where I could fit into the lineup.
And from what I remember from the street corner where we used to ball, you had a play style very similar to Shaq.
There we go.
Where you would use your size against me and kind of just back into me until I was behind the hoop, turn around and then just do a layup.
Yeah.
And I was kind of defenseless because I weighed 50 pounds as a 17-year-old. It's common. You know, happens to some of us. It's fine. But that's how I remember your play style. It was very Shaq. Like, I'm just going to box you out, turn around and drop the ball in the hoop.
And I really took advantage of the fact that the backboard was broken. So no matter how hard you threw it, if you hit the square on the backboard, it was going in the net.
Yeah.
So I would just beam it right at that thing and it would go in every time.
Yeah.
So I am an NBA free agent.
And looking.
And so, looking. I am available.
Any team you're after? You got your eye on anybody?
You know, Lakers, maybe. I think pairing with LeBron at the tail end of his career
would be a great fit.
Would be a good fit. But really, you know, I'll go wherever I'm needed.
Okay. Nuggets. You're a Nuggets kind of guy.
Okay. Yeah, that's fine with me. I'll go to Denver. I'll go Mile High.
I couldn't even have told you this. I was like, what is the The chicken nuggets.
The chicken nuggets.
That's what they should have named the team. I would buy a jersey tomorrow if they rebrand as the chicken nuggets.
There was a hockey team that recently changed their name, and everybody wanted them to be like the Yetis or something like that. Mm-hmm. But they ended up going a different route with it. But I can't remember what that is.
It'd be somewhere like Northwest, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm trying to think of which teams are around now that weren't before. Because there's, we have the Seattle Kraken. Maybe Seattle?
Maybe Seattle. Yeah, that could make sense.
Anyway, I'm sure all this ties in some way to Amelia Earhart and her legacy.
Yes, yeah, we're going to get into the most famous story that we have ever covered, but I do need to add some paranormal news. David here, preempting your show.
I'm on the beat, see?
So there is a bit of paranormal news going around right now.
Okay. Well, how do you, where does that come from? What's the cable that that information comes through?
I first saw it on Reddit, on r Bigfoot, but it's everywhere paranormal related right now.
Okay.
Apparently, a documentary was released at South by Southwest, the film festival. Mm-hmm. The documentary was about the Patterson-Gimlin film, which is like the famous Bigfoot film.
Yeah, I remember you and Trainer kind of mentioned that. I assume that's the one where he like walks by and then...
Yeah, walks by the creek bed, like the classic image of Bigfoot. Mm-hmm. That is from frame 352 of the Patterson-Gimlin film. I think I read somewhere the Patterson-Gimlin film is the second most analyzed piece of film in history. Mm-hmm. Second only to the Zapruder film, which is the JFK assassination.
Okay. I love the ones like the president's assassination and then a cryptid walking
then
in the woods.
Bigfoot is number two, yeah, right? And so this filmmaker released a documentary about the Patterson-Gimlin film and purportedly released in the documentary never before seen film that was given to him showing essentially like a dress rehearsal for the Patterson-Gimlin film.
He's the one that they're interviewing or he's talking? What's his name? Patterson-Gimlin?
Patterson-Gimlin. Those were the two people that were involved with the footage.
Oh, so it's like a slash or hyphen or whatever.
Yeah, yeah,
it's
yeah.
Two people. Okay, so are they talking to them and they're discussing their dress rehearsal? Are they still alive?
I think Bob Gimlin is still alive, but Roger Patterson passed away.
Okay, so they weren't the ones talking in this documentary.
No. Okay. The documentary is about the Patterson-Gimlin film, about the piece of footage.
Gotcha.
And purportedly, the filmmaker got a hold of a second reel of film that shows Patterson and Gimlin essentially doing a dress rehearsal for the famous Bigfoot film. And so it is saying essentially, here's the evidence that this is just a hoax.
So elaborate on what is in that second reel. Is it like you say dress rehearsal? I imagine that's putting on the costume, doing some tests to see like what makes the footage believable, something along those lines.
Yeah, I haven't seen it. The documentary, it was just shown at this film festival and hasn't been released publicly. So I don't know exactly what's on the film, mm-hmm. but the internet is abuzz with the Patterson-Gimlin film being proven to be a hoax.
Interesting. Knowing that it was there, I'm surprised you didn't buy a ticket. That's your guy.
Well, I didn't know that it was there. I don't think anybody really knew it.
It was like a surprise drop.
Yeah. But so, okay. You know, I'm holding out any opinions until I'm able to see it myself.
Yeah, I was going to say, does this like rock your foundation? Are you giving up on cryptids now?
That film, and this is going to ruffle some feathers, the Patterson-Gimlin film always felt too convenient for me. Mm-hmm. And so if it turns out it was a guy in a suit, I won't be overly surprised.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's the piece of paranormal news that's going around. And if I am able to watch that film before the end of the season, I'll definitely revisit it and give my opinions on it.
I'm curious, too, to see this because I wonder how believable the documentarians, is that what you call them? Documentaryers?
Documentary makers?
Documentaryers. I'm curious how believable they come across because who's to say they didn't fake their own second reel and like kind of go along those lines. But yeah, we'll have to check that one out and report back. I'm curious on that one.
Yeah, we'll see. Maybe we'll do a full episode about that film. I'll force you to watch it and then give me the full rundown.
Oh, I'm in. I love documentaries. I'm here for it. Yeah.
All right. So with all of that being said, let's talk about the most famous case we have ever covered. Amelia Earhart. I'm not even going to ask. I know you have heard of Amelia Earhart.
I have.
I know you know that she disappeared. I think most people would be able to say, oh yeah, Amelia Earhart. She was a pilot that disappeared.
Yes. Trying to fly across the Atlantic or circumnavigate the globe or something.
There you go. Circumnavigate the globe.
I was like, no biplane could do that. So were they going to refill her in the air and stuff? Or we'll get into that, I guess.
We'll get into that. She made a bunch of stops throughout it. It wasn't on a continuous flight.
Okay.
So yeah, we'll talk about Amelia Earhart. This is going to be a two-parter episode. And so today we're going to go through the whole story. From her early life, her rise to fame, we're going to cover the circumnavigation route and the preparations and all of that stuff, all the way to her disappearing. And then episode two, we're going to have a full theory episode.
Okay.
Because this almost 90-year-old case, there's been a lot of theories. There's a lot of details to go into with the theories. And so to do it justice, I'm just going to make that its own episode.
As you pointed out, we've all heard of it. As far as what her life was like, I couldn't really tell you much other than that she was just a female icon of like, hey, ladies, like, look what we can do. I couldn't tell you anything about her early life other than just that she tried to make this flight and disappeared. I don't think I could tell you anything beyond that.
And I was kind of the same. Like, I knew she tried to circumnavigate the globe. I knew some of the details about her disappearance and stuff, but I really didn't know anything about her early life. I knew that she was a famous feminist, but I didn't know why. And so it was interesting to get into her life, her career, all that stuff, all the barriers she was breaking as a woman in the 20s and 30s.
Yeah, very cool. So where do we jump in?
So we're jumping in 1897, July 24th. That is when Amelia Mary Earhart is born in Atchison, Kansas. And this was just a really interesting coincidence for me. The home she was born into is like 2 blocks away from my like number one bucket list haunted house in the United States, the Sally House.
Okay.
You could walk between them in like less than 10 minutes.
Interesting. Cool.
Yeah. So growing up, her dad struggled with alcoholism. He wasn't able to hold a job for very long. So there's a lot of financial strain. They moved a lot. She spent time living in Kansas, Iowa, Minnesota, Illinois. So she was kind of moving all over the place. And her mother raised her sort of in an unconventional way. I want to be clear that that's specifically for like the 20s and 30s, because the stuff she was doing, if she had done it today, people would have been like, okay, like, that's normal. Mm-hmm. But for the time, a woman being raised these ways and doing these things was totally different.
Yeah, gotcha.
The first example of that is her mom essentially raised her like, do what you want to do. Have fun. Investigate the things that you're interested in. Explore. Go outside. Get messy if you want to. Just do what you want to do and be your own person. So growing up as a child, Amelia was doing stuff like she was climbing trees. She was collecting insects, keeping them in jars. At one point, she built like a homemade ramp to take her bike off of. She was doing awesome things that kids should do, but wasn't normal at that time for a little girl to be doing these things.
Yeah, gotcha.
Amelia later in life credited her mother's upbringing paired with her dad's struggles and having to move all the time as like building her resilience, building her self-confidence, building her self-reliance, building her determination. A lot of mental pieces of Amelia Earhart came from the way she was raised by her mom and also the struggles imposed on the family by her dad's alcohol struggles.
What was the reason for relocating so much? Or do you know?
I think it was just trying to find work. Her dad trying to find work, trying to keep a job, et cetera, et cetera. And she just had to do what she had to do.
Yeah, gotcha.
Because you'll see her biggest asset was her determination. Like when Amelia Earhart got her mind set on something, she was going to do it.
Yeah.
And that comes from her upbringing. And so that's the first part of her life. And then in the mid-teens, World War I breaks out. She ends up in Toronto working as a nurse's aide, helping wounded soldiers that had come back from Europe, and she was tending to them. And it's at this time that she was first introduced to airplanes because there's planes bringing soldiers to and from the base that she's working on. And that started her fascination with aviation.
Gotcha.
She briefly attended Columbia University, but didn't complete a degree there. And then after the war died down, she found herself in California. And in 1920, she goes on her first plane ride. So she would have been 23 at this point. So she had never flown in a plane until she was 23. And she was at an air show, like I said, in California. And there was a pilot there by the name of Frank Hawks. And he was doing some sort of, you know, give me 10 bucks and you can ride in the plane. Right. And at the time, you know, in 1920, $10 was quite a bit more money than $10 is to us now. Either her or her parents pay the money and he takes her up in the plane, kind of flies low over the ground. And she says that this is the moment. This is when the light bulb went off of like, this is what I was born to do. Everything in her life changed when she took this plane ride in 1920. She was like, I got to do this. The next year, which was only a few months, I think, after this, because I think it was late 1920 that she went on that plane ride. Mm-hmm. So a few months later, 1921, she finds Anita Snook, one of very, very few female flying instructors in the United States, and she starts paying her for flying lessons. She works various jobs to make money just to pay for flying lessons. Like,
she's on her hustle.
Yeah. She worked part-time as a photographer. She did some truck driving, and sort of all of her resources were going towards these flying lessons.
And I assume she's just living on her own at this point, right? Not with the family, no husband in the picture, anything like that. She's just...
Yeah, she's on her own. And so again, 1920s, a female living on her own, a truck driver, taking flying lessons, like none of those things were common in the 1920s.
Yeah, right.
And later that year, 1921, she becomes the 16th woman ever to get her pilot's license. Next year, 1922, because she, again, she was determined. She was going to make a name for herself in aviation. Mm-hmm. And so just a year later, she sets the record for the highest altitude ever reached by a woman when she flew a plane to 14,000 feet.
Do you know what was the highest overall?
I don't know what the highest overall was at that point.
I'm curious if they're like, yeah, you can take the plane, but make sure you don't go higher than the man did. Or I'm always curious what happens in the background with stuff like that.
I would confidently say that if those were the instructions given to her, it would just drive her to beat it even more.
She just seems like the type who would be like, yeah, and then just go for the top record.
So yeah, she was not listening to any don't beat a man talk. And also in 1922, so after she sets the altitude record, she purchases her first plane. It was a bright yellow Kinner Airster, which I guess is a make and model of an airplane.
Sure.
She named it the Canary.
Nice. Fitting. Yeah. Is this, I'm picturing like a two wings stacked plane with a propeller in the middle on the front. Is that even close?
I think that's called a biplane. I don't think it was a biplane. I think it was like a single wing, two rotary engines would be my guess. So two propellers.
Okay. I don't know much about planes if you can't tell already.
Well, I, you know, my hope tonight is that we can sound more coherent about planes than we do about boats.
Or geography or many of the other things.
I've given up on boat knowledge. We just don't possess that.
Aft and then the other one. I still couldn't tell you which is which.
Stern?
Port.
So that's 1922. She gets her own plane. But in 1924, she finds herself having some financial struggles, ends up having to sell the plane. And for a time, she gets kind of discouraged with aviation and kind of takes a step back, is still sort of involved in the aviation world, but she's not flying as much. She moves to Boston. She starts working as a social worker while she's sort of, you know, on the weekends involved with the aviation community, but she's not really flying like she wants to.
Yeah. I mean, once you sell your plane, I imagine it's harder to get up in the air.
Right. And so she does that for a few years. And then on May 21st, 1927, Charles Lindbergh makes his famous flight in the Spirit of St. Louis and becomes the first person ever to fly solo across the Atlantic Ocean. And then in 1928, an organizer and publisher by the name of George Putnam decides he wants to essentially stage an event where the first woman ever flies across the Atlantic Ocean.
Okay.
And so he recruits Amelia Earhart, of course, to be the first woman ever to fly across the Atlantic Ocean. So on June 17th, 1928, she becomes the first woman ever to cross the Atlantic Ocean by airplane. This sort of starts her fame. This is what kind of gets her into public knowledge. Mm-hmm. She set an altitude record, but like, unless it involved in the aviation world, that doesn't mean much to them.
Yeah.
But because Lindbergh's flight was so famous and so many people knew about it, her becoming the first female to fly across the Atlantic Ocean, that got all sorts of publicity and a lot of people knew about it.
Mm-hmm.
However, the media is dubbing her Lady Lindy.
I'm sure she loved that.
Right?
That's like a Lindbergh shorthand, right?
Oh,
like,
yeah, yeah. Like, yeah. Lady Lindy. So essentially, they're just saying you're the woman
version of
of Charles Lindbergh. Yeah. And she readily comes out and basically blows the whole accomplishment up, because while she was the first woman to fly across the Atlantic Ocean,
mm-hmm.
she was on a plane with Wilmer Stoltz and Lewis Gordon, and they did all of the piloting. So essentially, this whole scheme cooked up by George Putnam was, let's just put a woman on a plane, have men fly it across the Atlantic, and then dub her Lady Lindy, the first woman to fly across the Atlantic.
Why did they want to do that? Was there money involved somehow in the promotion of it?
I don't think there was money involved directly in the accomplishment, but there certainly was from the publicity afterwards.
Yeah, I imagine like she probably didn't get much, if anything, for it other than like, hey, exposure.
Yeah.
But I'm surprised she would even agree to do that unless they also just maybe sold it a little different than what it ended up being. But I'm curious how that played out.
Yeah, my best guess is that they sold it to her as, you'll be the first woman to fly across the Atlantic. And then once she got on the plane, she was like, well, why are they in the pilot's chair?
Yeah. And then at a certain point, it's like, what are you going to like? Jump off the plane. You're just kind of
right
stuck. Yeah.
And so she comes out and is quoted as saying, I was just a sack of potatoes in this plane. Like, I did not fly across the Atlantic. I was just a passenger. I didn't accomplish anything. She's very open about this. She's not trying to own any fake fame or anything.
Yeah.
And this sort of sparks something in her. Like, she had that moment when she took that first plane ride. And then when this happens and she realizes, I didn't really do a whole lot, and starts her drive towards, I'm going to become a famous pilot.
And of my own volition and not, you know, men just parading me around as such.
Exactly. So she gets back into the aviation world, sort of quits being a social worker in Boston. And she's like, I'm going all in on aviation.
Mm-hmm.
In 1929, the next year, she enters the first ever women's cross-country air derby.
Okay.
So I'm guessing this is just a cross-country race by pilots, and she places third in that. The same year, she founds an organization called the 99s, which is an organization for licensed women pilots.
Okay.
I think there were like 99 licensed women.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why she called it the 99s. That group still exists.
Oh, cool.
I looked up their website. If you're a female pilot and you're listening to this, you can join the 99s. You've probably already heard of it. And then in 1931, she marries George Putnam.
Oh. Hmm.
The man who organized the transatlantic flight.
Yeah.
Now, this marriage, when you look up information about them getting married, the word controversial comes up a lot.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of questions about this marriage. And I think, as best I can tell, a lot of that wording and phrasing is coming from a fairly sexist place, because essentially the reason they're saying that this was a controversial marriage is because prior to getting married, she essentially was like, look, we can get married, but I'm going to keep doing my thing. I'm going to be a professional. I'm going to be a pilot. I'm going to do the things that I want to do. Just because I'm marrying you doesn't mean that you get to control my life or anything. And she essentially told George Putnam, you're coming along my ride rather than me, you know, cooking you dinner and making the house clean and all that stuff.
Yeah. Do you have any vibe that it was a marriage of convenience? Do you feel like they actually liked each other, or there was mutual benefit here in a non-romantic fashion?
When you read about it, everybody just gets hung up on, this was not a normal marriage. Nobody ever really talks about like their romantic involvement or them showing signs of affection. Nobody ever talks about that. They just talk about, like you said, it's really convenient that they got married because she's this famous person and he's this organizer. And so the marriage definitely was mutually beneficial for both of them. Mm-hmm. He is an organizer and can schedule all of these events and stuff to increase her fame. And she has ready access to that by having him as a husband.
Yeah.
But it's entirely possible that they did genuinely love each other.
Yeah, I guess we can't really say it. Not enough to...
Yeah, it's just not discussed. And so she marries him in 1931. Again, says essentially, you're going to be my agent and we're going to go through this life together, but I'm going to be the professional in the marriage. Mm-hmm. And George Putnam, like, is fully for this. He doesn't fight back about that in any sort of way. And he ends up playing like a major role in how people see Amelia Earhart. He had connections. And so he was able to arrange for her to go to various colleges and give lectures on things. He was able to get in touch with different companies and work on endorsement offers with Amelia. He got her a few publishing opportunities. She ended up authoring a couple of books. One of them's called 20 Hours, 40 Minutes about that Atlantic crossing. She wrote another book called The Fun of It, just detailing her aviation career. And he was the one setting up all of the publishing deals and distribution and all of that for her.
I mean, you called it. He sounds like her agent, promoter slash...
Oh, he definitely is. Yeah.
So that's interesting. Yeah. Huh.
She was already famous for that Atlantic crossing and being one of the first female pilots and everything. But this marriage sort of sends it into the stratosphere as far as people knowing who Amelia Earhart is.
Was Putnam involved at all with Lindbergh's flight?
No.
He just was doing the spinoff take where first woman.
Yeah.
Okay. So he saw that and then got the idea like, oh, let's get a woman.
Let's get a woman across and let's sell that, basically.
Okay.
So 1931, get married. 1932, Amelia becomes the second person ever to fly solo across the Atlantic Ocean. So that whole, like, the first woman ever to fly across the Atlantic, mm-hmm. she owned it. She said, I'm just a sack of potatoes in this plane. That, like, put a bug in her head. And in 1932, she became the first woman to ever fly solo across the Atlantic.
So in the end, she still did it.
Yeah, in the end, she still did it. And she was the second person ever after Lindbergh. She took off from Newfoundland and then she landed in Ireland. And she flew for about 15 hours straight. And she had planned to land in one of the bigger cities in Ireland. But I think weather made her divert course. And she ended up just landing in a field, like a farm field in like the countryside of Ireland.
Can you imagine being that farmer and be like, well, he'd be more like, I see something in the air.
So she lands and then famously a farmer runs up to her plane and his famous line to her is, have you flown far? And she's like, well, from North America.
Oh, shite.
So that happens in 1932. And then sort of into the mid 30s, she joins Purdue University as a faculty member. She is Purdue's career counselor for women, where she's encouraging women to pursue careers that traditionally are reserved for men. Mm-hmm. And she would teach them things like financial independence, technical competence, skills that were not readily being taught to women. She was passing all that along.
Yeah. And this is like not that long ago.
Right.
Right.
Like 90 years ago.
I always have to remind myself, oh, this is like grandma's mom was around.
Yeah.
For this. So yeah, not that far back.
I have a great aunt that I believe is 94. She was born before Amelia Earhart's flight.
Yeah.
Right. Like she was born into this time period.
Yeah, that's wild.
That's mid-30s. She's working with Purdue as a career counselor. 1935, she becomes the first person ever, man or woman, to fly solo from Hawaii to Oakland, California.
It's quite the switch up.
Right.
Very different vibe to Honolulu.
I would imagine even so in the 1930s. So yeah, she becomes the first person ever to do that flight. And that is widely regarded as a more technical route than the Atlantic crossing.
Is that because of weather or jet streams?
I would assume it's further and probably some of those factors as well.
Okay. Speaking of our poor geography, I think my frame of reference is always just it being an inset in a map without the actual distance context.
Oh, yeah. It's like in the middle of the Atlantic. It's sort of like you see Alaska on a map and you're like, oh, okay.
But it's like right next to Russia.
It's next to Russia, and it is by far the largest landmass state in the United States. Like Alaska is the size of like a third of the continental United States.
Oh, I knew it was big. So it's bigger than Texas?
Oh, by a wide margin.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, okay.
We'll put some maps on Instagram.
We'll look this up after the episode because I just don't trust us. But no, I knew Alaska was big. I thought it was like number two. But so to bring us back in, I'm dumb as and I don't know where Hawaii is.
So she sets that record. She also sets a few other records, speed and distance records, including flights from Los Angeles to Mexico City. She sets another record from Mexico City to Newark. So she's sort of setting records, doing a lot of flying.
So as she's doing all this stuff, like, is she a household name?
Yes. People in the 30s knew Amelia Earhart. And one note that I skipped over here is in 1933, she became a fashion icon.
Oh, okay.
She launched one of the very first ever practical clothing lines for women.
But what is that?
That you can move in, not like tight dresses and corsets. She released activewear for women when that wasn't a thing. Women weren't exercising. They were in the kitchen, right? And she was like, no, that's incredibly stupid. Women need clothing that they can do things in. She was Lululemon before Lululemon existed, right?
Yeah.
And it was called Amelia Earhart Fashion.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
So she has all these flight records. She has a brand new clothing line that's like a whole new concept for clothing. She's setting all these records and she's sort of towards the tail end of her career as a famous pilot and public icon and everything. She's been flying for 15 years.
So how old is she at this point, roughly?
1937, which is where we're getting to. She would be 40 years old.
Okay.
Yeah, she's getting towards the end of her career, essentially.
When you say that, because we know what happens or because that's kind of where you stop flying, that still sounds pretty young. Like, I feel like when I take a United flight, I'll see some pilots well past 40, for better or worse, where I'm like, I hope we get to Texas.
Well, I think a commercial airline pilot in 2026 is a lot different from a transatlantic solo flight in the 30s.
All right. Well.
But so the reason I say that this was like the tail end of her career is because it's kind of known that her and her husband, George Putnam, sort of got together and they were like, okay, let's come up with like one last hurrah, one last big thing, and then we can wind it down and just essentially live off the residuals and doing endorsements. And like, you don't need to take any more huge risks in the air.
Yeah, one more big event so we can basically retire, live our remaining days.
Live our lives. Like, you could still fly and everything, but like, you don't need to be doing these wild stunts and trying to set records and stuff.
Yeah.
And as far as I can tell, she was on board with this too.
Yeah, that was going to be my question. Was that a mutual decision? But as far as we know, she was on board.
As far as we can
tell. Pardon the pun.
And so,
sorry, I had to.
And so they start prepping. The idea that they come up with is we're going to circumnavigate the globe.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have to take a few steps because they're going to be flying 29,000 miles was the route that they had picked. And that's how long it was going to take, et cetera, et cetera. 29,000 miles. They get with Purdue University, the university that she had been teaching at.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, they sort of pitched it as we're doing scientific research and we're going to take all these scientific tools on board and take all of these readings and recordings and help you with, I don't even know what kind of research, but they essentially pitched it to Purdue as a research expedition in an attempt to get them to finance the trip. They didn't really have any intention on doing any sort of science on this journey, but Purdue falls for it.
It's good publicity. Their name would be brought up in, yeah, I assume, some capacity that would benefit them.
Right. Their name would be brought up on the Oddity Archive in 2026.
Yeah, see, it's still working. I'm picturing her holding like a barometer.
Yeah.
What measures pressure?
Barometer. Yeah.
Yeah. Just holding that out the side window while she's like flying across to her. It's like, I don't know how they thought this would work, but yeah, sure. Purdue University. A great university that everyone should attend with very cheap tuition.
Yes, absolutely. Purdue, the official university of the Oddity Archive.
Bing! There we go. Shameless plug.
There done. We go. We're going to have a sponsor by the end of this season.
I don't care if the quality drops a ton, as long as we get one sponsor by the end of the season.
I'm going to be emailing so many small businesses.
No. You're a snail mail kind of guy. You're going to be sending letters.
I'll mail as many as I need to.
Okay, so they're making this 29,000-mile flight crossing the globe.
Yeah. She gets Purdue to essentially bankroll the project. And to do this, she gets a Lockheed Electra 10E. That is the aircraft that she used for this journey.
And that's the Lockheed that's still around? Lockheed Martin? I assume that, merged.
Yeah, same company.
But yeah, okay.
Yeah. So Lockheed Electra 10E, obviously they're going to modify it for something like this. And the modification that they did was a standard Lockheed Electra 10E holds about 200 gallons of fuel. Mm-hmm. They modified Earhart's Electra 10E to hold 1,150 gallons of gasoline. And so essentially all the modification that they did was they stripped everything out of the interior and filled the interior with gas tanks. So the whole inside of the plane was like the two cockpit seats, a whole bunch of gas tanks, and then a really primitive toilet in the back of the plane.
I never thought about the toilet.
Yeah.
Never thought about it.
Well, you did now.
That's why Purdue was involved. They had to come up with the toilet system.
The toilet system, yeah.
It's underwear with a tube. And she's like, I'm listening.
And it essentially, because they had to cut weight as much as possible, because they're holding almost 1,000 more gallons of fuel than this plane is modified for.
Yeah. Had to hollow it out. And so was the weight roughly the same after they made those modifications? Or
it was way heavier.
Still over? By
a lot, yeah, way heavier when it was full. But it was still under the required takeoff weight.
Okay. Because that's like 5 times the amount of fuel. Like that's... Not nothing.
Yeah, it's a lot of fuel.
Yeah.
And so the quote unquote bathroom was essentially like a bucket in the back of the plane. But that was everything. So they had this thing like ready to go. They decide that they are going to fly west across the globe, starting off from Oakland.
Okay.
So in March of 1937, they take off from Oakland, Hawaii. And this was
California.
Yeah, Oakland, California.
You said Hawaii. I was like, what?
They're going to Hawaii.
Yes.
And this was not a solo thing. She did have a navigator with her. And her navigator for this leg of the trip was Paul Mance. He was a renowned air racer and stunt pilot. He was known in the aviation world as one of, if not the best navigators in the entire world.
I guess you have a compass or something. I'm just curious how you navigate when you're just over open water where you're going, but it's got to be like a compass and knowing your speed.
So I'll get into that.
Okay.
I don't know exactly what methods Paul Mance used, but we'll get into
how they would navigate that path.
Yeah, in a minute.
Okay.
So Paul Mance is the navigator, and she goes from Oakland to Hawaii, and that's successful. They land in Hawaii. Everything's good to go. And then they go to take off from Hawaii and they suffer what's called a ground loop accident. And they end up having to abandon the mission.
Oh, okay.
I looked up a ground loop, and this is just a quote from a Google search. A ground loop is an uncontrolled, rapid, horizontal rotation of an aircraft during taxi takeoff or landing, often causing the plane to spin, drag a wingtip, or damage its landing gear. It is primarily a loss of directional control frequently associated with tailwind aircraft due to their center of gravity being behind the main wheels. So essentially, the takeoff in Hawaii goes wrong, and the aircraft is damaged, and they have to abandon the mission. And then they get the plane back to Oakland because that's kind of their main base, I'm guessing.
So it's a full reset at this point.
Yeah, full reset. They get it back to Oakland. They do whatever repairs are needed to make it ready to take off again. And Paul Mance essentially loses faith in Amelia as a pilot after the ground loop accident and is like, look, guys, I'm out. I can't do this. I'm not going to be the navigator for this. And so, of course, she had a big team of people that was helping her with this mission. And so one of the men on the team, Fred Noonan, he sort of gets appointed the position of navigator.
How do you feel about Paul Mance dropping out?
I think ultimately it ended up being a good decision. of course he knew about Amelia Earhart. Maybe he hadn't flown with her a whole lot. And when this ground loop accident happened, he was like, maybe she's not that great of a pilot. I don't know if I want to go on this risky journey. Like, imagine if you got recruited to like go on a flight around the world and day two, the pilot causes an accident. It wouldn't matter who that pilot is. That could be like the greatest pilot in the world. You'd be like, I don't know about this, right?
Yeah.
And so he backs out and Fred Noonan gets appointed the navigator.
Did he have similar clout to Mr. Mance?
He was an American flight navigator. He was also a sea captain.
Okay.
So he used sort of a different type of navigation. He was the best celestial navigator on the planet. So like navigating using the stars. And that comes a lot from him being a sea captain.
Right.
I see your eyes, your head spinning.
Well, I'm just thinking like it's cloudy. I guess you go above the clouds when you fly. With these planes, I just don't have a good frame of reference. Like I know when we fly commercial airlines, you go above the clouds so you could see the stars and stuff. But my wheels are going as far as like this guy coming in being more of a sea captain leaning guy.
Yeah.
If that would affect this mission. So I'm already like kind of thinking about where we know things end up, how this might affect that.
Right. And so let me add on to, so he's the best celestial navigator in the world. He was also extremely skilled at a type of navigation called dead reckoning. And dead reckoning is a navigation technique essentially where you find a fixed point, a landmark, a building, a piece of land of some sort, and you know where that is in relation to the plane, and you know which direction you're heading, and you know what speed you're going, and you can figure out when you're going to get to wherever.
Okay.
Dead reckoning is sort of like what you were talking about, where it's like, okay, I know I am right here. Mm-hmm. I have a compass. I have a stopwatch. I have a map. I can figure out where I'm going to be in 30 minutes.
Okay. It's an intense name for that.
Yeah, dead reckoning. Which yeah. Also, if you remember, for the years that I had the idea to make this podcast, the title for the podcast that was in my head was Dead Reckoning.
I was like, it sounds familiar. We had a pretty good list of names. I think we landed on the right thing in the end, but
yeah, I think it worked out. And so he's good at both of those techniques, celestial navigation, also dead reckoning. Dead reckoning technique will play a major part in the next episode when we talk about theories. So Fred Noonan is on the thing now. Also, I'll throw this note out there because it's reported in a lot of places, he was quite a drinker.
Do we know what they took on board and stuff? Would they be like, and one huge flask?
So that may or may not come up in the theories. I can't remember. So they get all the repairs done. Fred Noonan is appointed navigator. And on May 20th, 1937, they take off from Oakland, California. And this time they decide we're not going to fly west. We're going to fly east. So they decide to fly the other direction around the world for the second attempt.
Any reason for that change or just bad vibes from last time?
Yeah,
let's mix it up.
Let's just switch it up a little bit, right? For the next minute, I'm going to pummel you.
Ow.
With the route that they took.
Okay.
This isn't extremely important, but I feel like when people get to this part of the story, they just jump right to the end.
Yes.
You know, okay, let's talk about how they disappeared. And for me, it's important for people to know just how huge of an undertaking this whole thing was.
Yeah.
Because when she disappeared, she was almost done with circumnavigating the globe.
I say, yeah, like I know, but I mean, all I knew was that it didn't succeed.
Exactly. I had no idea that she was as accomplished a pilot as she was. I knew that she was a feminist icon, but I didn't really know why she was. Mm-hmm. So researching this really has brought all that into the forefront. But so I'm going to run through the whole route that she took. Destinations, distances. This is going to take a while.
Do you want like a little underscore while you do this when I start putting it together?
Yeah.
We'll be some good like airline kind of vibe music.
Yeah, do some airline music while I'm doing this. Again, this is just to get an idea of how huge of an undertaking this was.
Yeah, yeah. Lay it out for us.
May 20th, 1937, she goes Oakland to Burbank, 283 miles. On May 21st, Burbank to Tucson, 393 miles. May 22nd, Tucson to New Orleans, 1,070 miles. May 23rd, New Orleans to
Fortaleza, Brazil to Natal, Brazil, 235 miles. Natal, Brazil to St. Louis, French West Africa, now Senegal, 1,727 miles.
And 70 miles. May 23rd, New Orleans to Miami, 586 miles. On June 1st, Miami to San Juan, Puerto Rico, 908 miles. June 2nd, San Juan, Puerto Rico.
Whew. Okay.
Do you need a drink of water?
Yeah, I'm going to take a drink of water.
What was the last stop? Sorry, I was scribbling frantically.
So she ends up on June 29th in Ley, New Guinea, acknowledging that I pronounced a lot of those things wrong. A lot of those countries don't exist anymore because a lot of that was just colonial things.
I was going to say a lot of very depressing sounding colonialism in the mix.
Yeah. So quite a journey that she's been on, right?
I'm curious on the mileage, if you have any insight on it. If not, it's just interesting to me that most of it was like 100 to 300 miles, which sounds like you'd do pretty fast in a plane. Mm-hmm. But then towards the tail end, all of a sudden, it's like 445 miles. And then to close out, over 1,000.
Yeah.
Was she just getting like antsy to finish? Or is this just the route that had to be taken? Why such a longer trek on the tail end of this?
So the route was pre-planned. They didn't just take off and then like, let's have a short day today. Yeah, let's land, right? The whole route was pre-planned with airstrips that were safe for her to land at.
Because a lot of forts, I also heard, I imagine military bases where they could land, refill.
Yeah, some military bases across Africa at that time, across lower Asia, Southeast Asia. She had to pick the airports she could get to that made sense for her to stop at. And so sometimes she's flying 300 miles, other times she's flying 1,700 miles.
I was in my head thinking, oh, this was like that travel day. But no, if it's 100 miles, maybe that was a few hours, stop there, refuel, go to the next one.
Yeah, because again, part of the organization for this was making sure she can fuel up at every spot, that there's going to be some level of mechanic at each spot that can help with fixing anything on the plane that needs to be fixed, et cetera, et cetera. So this was a precisely planned trip.
Yeah.
To get across.
I mean, I hope.
Yeah.
They would, yeah.
And there was that one where she went back and forth across. So she went from, and I'm saying this wrong, but Bandung, Dutch East Indies to Sorabia, Dutch East Indies, mm-hmm. 310 miles. And then because the plane needed repairs and Amelia Earhart actually got ill with dysentery.
That toilet in the back is like.
Right. But they didn't have the proper mechanic or the proper medical care in Sorabia. Mm-hmm. Instead of going to the next stop, which was 668 miles away in Kopang, they decided to go back to Bandung or Bandung. I don't know how to say that. Dutch East Indies.
Well, dysentery, that's like, I mean, that's what killed everybody on the Oregon Trail.
Yeah.
But it's not light, right? That's like.
No. Like, oh, yeah, okay. She was ill.
Helicopter. She, they're coming for me, David.
You talking about Amelia?
Remember me as I was, as a podcaster.
You talking about Amelia?
Get them. They're on the part where she's shitting herself.
Yeah. They went to the next stop, and then they were like, oh, she's really ill, and the plane needs repairs. We can't handle either of those on this stop. So they went back to the previous stop, handled all of that stuff, and then went again back to...
But you say go back, like, she's still flying, but sick, right?
Oh, yeah.
Or is, what's his face, the navigator, like, I'll take over for a bit.
No, she's flying. Yeah, she is flying with dysentery for 300 miles.
So I imagine Noonan's there, also himself, but for other reasons, where he's like, she's throwing up all over herself, flying this plane back.
And remember, he would take the controls when she had to go, like, use the bucket in the back of the plane, right?
The Purdue dumper, as we call it.
Purdue dumper. Also my nickname in high school.
There's our next shirt. I'm Purdue.
I got a real Purdue dumper.
I'm seeing a college trifold pamphlet that says like I'm a Purdue dumper. Anyway, I think we just lost our sponsorship from Purdue University. And we were so close.
Purdue, the official university.
The official dumper.
So she goes back and forth there with dysentery, like not feeling well, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That was one hang up. There were a couple times during the journey that weather delayed them. They hit like monsoon season in Southeast Asia, so they had to wait a day or two to take off from there. There were a couple different things that happened.
How many days are we in after all of that?
Well, let's see. When was the first one was May 20th, and now we're on July 2nd.
Okay, so 2 months. Ish.
Yeah, like 40 to 45 days into the journey.
Okay.
And we find ourselves on Ley, New Guinea. They have traveled, of the 29,000 miles, they have traveled 22,000 so far.
Okay.
The remaining route was Ley, New Guinea to Howland Island. And then they were going to go from Howland Island to Hawaii and then Hawaii to Oakland. So they only had three legs left. And the next route from Ley, New Guinea to Howland Island was going to be the longest stretch of the entire circumnavigation. They were scheduled to fly 2,223 miles to get from where they are, Ley, New Guinea to Howland Island. This was the longest stretch.
I mean, by double.
By quite a bit. I think there was one stretch in the middle where they went 1,700.
Okay. But still, like, they're finishing pretty aggressively.
Yeah. And this is because they have to get across the Pacific and there just isn't a lot of land there.
Yeah. Okay.
And so they had to like really pick and choose where they were landing.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like they could go 300 miles and land. If they did that, they'd just end up in the water, which they may have. We don't know.
Well,
So yeah, Ley to Howland Island is the next leg of the journey. It was also the most technically difficult portion of the entire mission because they're taking off from New Guinea. They're flying 2,200 miles into the Pacific Ocean, and they have to find Howland Island, which is 1.5 square miles.
So I don't want to start pointing fingers yet, but Noonan had his work cut out for him.
Absolutely. Yeah. Navigation was going to be a very difficult piece with this stretch.
Had she flown to this island previously ever before to know how small it was and how complicated that might be to pull off?
No, she had never flown there. Howland Island, like I said, 1.5 square miles in the middle of the Pacific. It's uninhabited. Nobody lives there.
How do they even know they could land?
We knew that the island existed because it's been mapped.
Yeah.
People had been there. It's just nobody had ever lived on Howland Island.
So hopefully there's at least enough intel to say it's flat. There's not tons of trees. You'll be able to at least land. But even that sounds like a lot of trust to put in a thing I hadn't seen myself.
Right. And because, again, this was a major operation, they had a U.S. Coast Guard ship. The U.S. CGC Itasca was stationed at Howland Island, essentially to help guide them in with radio. Hey, we see you. We don't see you. What's your heading? You know, to coordinate getting to Howland Island.
So there's feet on the ground, at least.
Yeah, there's feet on the ground for this journey.
Okay.
Saying you can land a plane here and we'll have people there. We'll have fuel for you. We'll have a mechanic. We'll have food. We'll have everything that you need.
Oh, right. Like they're landing because they need to reset effectively.
Yeah. 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 Everything was set up at Howland Island for them to get there and land. So they're in New Guinea and they actually had to delay takeoff for a few days. And there are some reports of really bad weather.
Mm-hmm.
Amelia Earhart wrote that, quote, the wind was blowing the wrong way. So in addition to that, there were purportedly some navigation issues. Noonan said that he was having trouble setting his navigation instruments properly. He had to calibrate his navigation instruments with some sort of radio time signals. I don't know a whole lot about that, but because he relied on dead reckoning, which is very time intensive, like your tools need to be extremely precise and you need to be able to keep time extremely precisely.
Mm-hmm.
And he was having a lot of trouble calibrating them because something about the radio signal that was giving him the time wasn't coming in very strong. He wasn't reliably receiving this time signal.
You hit a thing where I was just curious what tools he's using to do this. And I think as humans, we have a bad habit of picturing the 1940s-ish as like having no technology at all or being very like rudimentary, but I feel like there was pretty good tools still. I mean, yeah, they've made it almost around the entire globe doing this system. So it must have some credence to it.
Absolutely.
But I'm also curious, like, how quickly could that fall apart given bad weather conditions or something like that? I'm curious what kind of stuff he was using to make this journey.
But, oh, yeah.
But, I mean, they're just about there.
Right. So they're just about there. And they're trying to find a needle in a haystack with Howland Island. And so him having, like, his stopwatch, I'll say, timed precisely is extremely important. And he's saying that what I'm picturing when he's saying that the radio time signals aren't coming through properly is that there was some sort of radio signal being sent to them, sort of like a metronome, maybe a haunted one.
On a piano.
On a piano. Yeah. There's some sort of like beep, beep, beep that was being radioed to them so that he could calibrate his instrument. So like, okay, every 2 seconds there's a tone and he can keep time with that and make sure that his stopwatch is going 2 seconds every tone, et cetera, et cetera. That's what I'm picturing.
I see. I'll have to procrastinate at work tomorrow and look into 1940s aviation equipment.
And then finally, they did a little more weight reduction. They removed some other unnecessary items to reduce weight. They packed the plane full of as much fuel as they could possibly fit into it. And then finally, on July 2nd, they take off from Leh, New Guinea. There is like one really grainy video of their final takeoff, and you can see the plane is like really weighed down on the runway because there's so much fuel in it.
This is the long trek, right? It's going 2,200 miles.
Yeah, so they got to get every ounce of gasoline they can into this plane.
Yeah.
And so when you watch that really grainy video, you can like tell this thing is heavy.
Like bowed out.
Yeah. From reports of people on the ground, they said that the plane hovered just above the ocean for quite a while until enough fuel was burned off that it could gain some altitude because it had burned off some weight.
Yeah.
They had as much fuel as you could possibly get into that thing. The flight was scheduled to be 18 to 20 hours. And like I said, the Itasca was stationed at Howland Island with the job of transmitting radio signals. They were prepared to provide some smoke signals if that would be of any benefit to help guide them in. They were essentially the airport on Howland Island.
Yep.
As their takeoff, Earhart is maintaining intermittent radio contact with the Itasca. There's several transmissions between her and the boat. She did progressively over the course of these messages is starting to express some difficulty with locating the island. And then her very last messages that were ever sent were the ones that Jess read for us in the opening. She said, "We must be on you, but cannot see you. Fuel is running low." And then her very last confirmed transmission was, "We are on the line 157-337 running north and south." She was never heard from, seen, or any identifying information about her, Fred Noonan, or the plane has ever been found after she sent that last message.
So the numbers that she's reading out, can you elaborate on what those are referencing?
For the theory section, I'll look up like what exactly those coordinates are, because I'm imagining it's like a latitude or a longitude. And she's saying we're running north and south, meaning like I think they call it like mowing the lawn, trying to just cover space to find what you're looking for.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I'm curious if just being cocky on finding that small spot.
It was already find a needle in a haystack situation. If you go on Google Maps and you look up Howland Island, it is insane to me that that would be the target. Like, it is so in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the Pacific with nothing near it. And I'm not saying they had better options or like this was a bad decision to choose Howland Island. Like, it was probably the best option that they had. But it's just crazy that they were going to fly 2,200 miles and land on this tiny speck of land in the middle of the Pacific.
I mean, a human could run end to end on this island in 7 to 10 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, that's tiny. That's very small. Yeah.
Yeah. It's extremely small.
And with a guy locating with a stopwatch and a map or whatever.
Yeah. Like, gotta fix his timing with direction, speed, time, and aiming for Howland Island. Now, he was very good at it. He was the best person at celestial navigation. He was one of the best at Dead Reckoning in the entire world. So if there was someone that could do it, it would be him. It just seems like, I'm telling you, look up Howland Island on Google Maps and then just zoom out. There's nothing there. It's crazy.
Probably was the only option. I'm just curious how, if ego was getting in the way of like being overconfident on what was possible.
Do you mean just in like the whole idea of circumnavigating the globe?
I mean, to a degree, yes. But also, like, I get the pursuit. I'm wondering if that's why Mance, was that the initial guy?
Paul Mance.
Well, maybe I should save all this for the next thing when we get into theories and stuff, because I'm already like, oh, but maybe this, but... You know, maybe that's why they changed directions, was because that initial leg was so tough. He was starting to get concerned about if they'd be able to find that island or not. But I digress. So how do you want to wrap out the ledge we're hanging everybody on here?
The line that I had rehearsed was that on July 2nd, 1937, Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan took off from Ley, New Guinea and landed in the history books. Whew. That was good. That was a good scripted line. I like that. I did good on that one.
We'll be
back with part two, hopefully in a couple weeks from now. The whole episode is going to be theories. All of the theories. And the theories have a wide range.
I was ready to like jump into it. And I was like, there's a reason he's holding back.
It is everything from the plane went down in the ocean all the way to she's living in New Jersey. So...
Her and Putnam are down in Mexico, just on the beach.
Right, with Morgan Freeman.
Sure. Why not?
What's his name?
Oh, Matt Damon?
No, from Shawshank Redemption.
Morgan Freeman. Oh, Tim Robbins?
Yes, Tim Robbins.
Yeah. He's like 7 feet tall. And
I don't want to hear any no spoilers comments, okay?
On Shawshank. Well, it plays daily on most channels.
It's such a good movie.
So, yeah.
Anyways.
But, you know, he's like 17 feet tall. He's huge. They had to, like, shoot the whole film to make him look smaller. Because the warden was supposed to be menacing, but he was just, like, towering over them. Like, this isn't working. Get Tim to kneel down.
Take anyways, a knee.
So that's
take
the
knee.
Film nerd coming up. okay, cool. Well, as usual, keep an eye out for the Instagram post just for a little bit of context. I think a little visual goes a long way. But that's Oddity Archive Podcast on Instagram. And Gmail, I always forget because I feel like there's a caveat.
OddityArchivePodcast@gmail.com.
So no caveat, just poor memory skills on my part. David is so lonely. He needs these emails. I don't talk to him.
The only email I've gotten in the past 2 months is... Your distribution service is set to expire and will renew on such date. So, you know.
Does that mean you're going to send me a Venmo that I owe money?
You owe money. Money.
money. Well, I don't have $30 to spare.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Well, thanks for hanging out on this one. Welcome back. Season 3 is off and running.
Let's do this.
And we'll see you guys for... Part 1, 2, 3.
What?
1, 2. I thought we were going to do let's do this. And we have a bad habit of our unisons always fail.
1, 2, 3. Let's do this.
That's my Amelia from the start.
There you go. Okay.
Still, no, you're still not buying it. It's fine.
I am David Stooldreyer, creator and host. The show is edited by my co-host, Evan Miller. All original music created by Sean Bullock. You can follow him at Sean Bullock Video on Instagram. All original artwork done by Tannis. Follow her at Tannis Tattoos on Instagram as well. Thank you for listening.